You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz. This is lecture 13 in the collection, given in Munich on the 9th of January, 1912, entitled Cosmic Ego and Human Ego, Supersensible Microcosmic Beings, The Nature of Christ. This evening we need to talk further about the nature of Christ Jesus. It is necessary because this theme is so much under discussion at present, particularly in theosophical circles, and because there is a very real need to reach complete clarity on much that is said about it. Many may regard the issue we will examine today as rather odd, yet it is a very important one. We will start from human evolution. We know, of course, that evolution progresses by means of humanity passing through certain cyclical epochs. And we have often spoken of the five cultural epochs, up to and including our own time, which followed the great catastrophe that transformed life on the ancient continent we call Atlantis into our life on the newer continents. We speak of the first, the ancient Indian epoch, the second, the great cultural epoch of ancient Persia, the third, the Egyptian, Chaldean, Babylonian culture, the fourth, the Greco-Roman, which a broader view of things considers did not really fade away until sometime between the 8th and 12th post-Christian centuries A.D., and then of our present 5th post-Atlantean cultural epoch, which began in 1413. Now human souls, all those who sit here, of course, included, have passed through various incarnations in these succeeding cultural epochs up to the present time. Some incarnating more frequently, others passing through relatively fewer incarnations. These souls have acquired this or that characteristic from their experiences, according to the nature of each of these epochs, and carried it with them from earlier into later incarnations. In other words, they manifest as souls at this or that stage of development according to what they experienced in various previous cultural epochs. Now we can further say that on the whole, and this is only a general rule, only a particular member or aspect of man's nature is evolved and developed in each cultural epoch. In our own epoch, people are chiefly called upon to develop what in our movement we term the consciousness soul, by allowing to work upon them everything which our epoch can give them. During the Greco-Roman period, in contrast, the mind or rational soul mainly evolved, while in the Egyptian, Chaldean, Babylonian period, it was the sentient soul. In ancient Persian civilization, the sentient or astral body developed, and in ancient India, what we call the etheric or life body. These various parts of man's being have been developed in each individual soul, or will be, as it passes in one or, more often, several incarnations through each of these cultural epochs. In the 6th post-Atlantean cultural epoch, that follows our present one, what we term spirit self will chiefly be developed, or manas, as people are used to calling it in theosophical literature. And in the last, the 7th post-Atlantean cultural epoch, what we call life spirit will evolve, termed buddhi in theosophical circles. Spirit man, or atma, will in a certain sense only unfold in a far distant future, following a further catastrophe. At present, therefore, and in the near future, we are in the midst of developing what is called the consciousness soul, by living through the everyday conditions of our culture, of what surrounds us, But we know that all this evolution of the separate members we distinguish within the soul is intimately related to something else, to the gradual incorporation of the human ego in human nature, which is the whole task and aim of earthly evolution. Thus, we have, as it were, two interpenetrating streams of evolution. There is the earth evolution we are passing through, following Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolution. And then, as earthly humanity, we have the particular task of developing this fourth member of human nature, of adding this ego to the other principal members of human nature, to the physical, etheric, and astral bodies. We have to distinguish between these two, between the larger span of the overall stream of evolution, related to the great embodiments of our Earth planet itself, and that smaller scale stream of evolution, which I described previously, as occurring within the comparatively short span of the post-Atlantean period. No one who has understood what has been said will be able to ask, quote, "But how can it be that on Old Sun man had already developed the etheric or life body, and that then a special development of this same body is said to have taken place during the ancient Indian epoch?" Close quote. Those who have rightly understood will not ask such a question, for the facts are these. The human etheric or life body was implanted in us on Old Sun, and so we arrived at the stage of Earth evolution in possession of an etheric body. But it can then be refined and further developed, can be worked upon by subsequent soul members which human beings evolve. In other words, man receives his etheric or life body at a particular fairly advanced stage when he incarnates in an ancient Indian body. But during this post-Atlantean period, he works upon it with the ego, and everything he has acquired so far makes it finer structured. So what develops and evolves in our post-Atlantean cultural epoch is essentially a refining, a finer working into the various members of human nature. If you now examine all of evolution and consider what has been said, the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the Greco-Roman, will appear to you as of quite particular importance. For it is there that a greater degree of refining must occur within the mind or rational soul. But up to that time, the ego, which belongs to the greater evolutionary stream, has undergone an especially high degree of development. We can say that up to the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, up to the Greco-Roman times, this human ego has evolved to a certain stage, and now it must penetrate the mind or rational soul, and in our time, the consciousness soul. Now, in a certain sense, there is an intimate relationship between the human ego and man's three soul members, the sentient soul, the mind or rational soul, and the consciousness soul. It is in these three soul members of our being that the inner life of the human ego chiefly dwells. And in our fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch in particular, it will live most inwardly in the consciousness soul, because it is there that the pure ego can express itself unhindered by the other bodies. In our present time, we are indeed living in an epoch in which this ego is most called upon to develop, to build upon its own foundations. And if we then cast our gaze forward into the future, and say that in the next, the sixth cultural epoch, man will evolve the spirit self, or manas, we recognize that this spirit self is really already a step beyond the sphere of the ego. Basically, we would be unable to evolve this spirit self in the future through our own powers, but are dependent on the help flowing toward us from higher beings. We have reached a stage in the evolution of our ego where we can only rely on our own powers to evolve as far as the consciousness soul. But this evolution will not be complete unless we anticipate and in a certain sense prefigure, the more advanced stage that will only fully come about on Jupiter, that will only attain its complete, inherently human evolution on the next embodiment of our planet. Up until the end of Earth evolution, man is meant to develop his ego. He has had an opportunity to carry out this development within the sentient mind and consciousness soul. But the real spirit self will only become human property, our real possession, on Jupiter. On Jupiter, we will have the same kind of relationship to the spirit self as we do here on Earth to the ego. In other words, if we develop spirit self already during the Earth cycle, we cannot yet have the same relationship to it as we do to the ego. Of our ego, we say, quote, "We are that. That is what we truly are." Close quote. But when, in the next epoch, the sixth post-Atlantean, the spirit self comes to expression, we will not be able to refer to this spirit self as our self, but will say, quote, "Our ego has evolved to a certain stage where our spirit self can shine in as though from higher worlds, like a kind of angel being that is other than what we are, can shine in upon us and take possession of us." Close quote. That is how our spirit self will appear to us. And only on Jupiter will it appear in such a way that it becomes our own true being, like our ego. In such a way does human evolution advance. Thus in the next, the sixth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, we will feel as though drawn to what shines in upon us. We will not refer to our spirit self as though it were within us, but will say, quote, "I participate in a being who shines in upon me from higher worlds, that God leads and guides me, that has come to be my leader and guide through the grace of higher beings." Close quote. That aspect of our being that will only become our real possession on Jupiter, we will experience as a kind of guiding light shining down upon and into us from higher worlds. And it will later be the same with the life spirit or Buddhi, and with spirit man, and so forth. Thus a time will come when we speak differently of ourselves than we do now. How do we speak of ourselves when we refer to ourselves in spiritual scientific terms? We say, quote, "I have three bodies, physical, etheric, and astral. Within these, I have my ego, as real earthly possession, developing within these three bodies. These three bodies are, as it were, my lower nature. I have grown beyond them, and look down to this my lower nature, seeing in what my ego has become my true being for the present, which increasingly is to grow, to develop more and more." Close quote. In future, we will have to speak differently. We will say, quote, "I do not just have my lower nature and my ego, but I have a higher nature, which I look up to as something that is part of me in the same way as the bodily sheaths I received in the past." Close quote. In other words, we will in future feel ourselves placed midway between our lower and higher nature. We already know our lower nature. In the future, we will come to know our higher nature as something above us, in the same way we now experience our lower nature below us. So we can say that during earthly evolution, we grow from our fourth to our fifth, sixth, and seventh aspect. But the fifth, sixth, and seventh aspects will not become our direct possession during actual earth evolution, but will be something we only gradually attain to. This is how we should really view things. A time will come when we experience that although it was our earthly mission to develop our ego, we nevertheless have a kind of prophetic anticipation of our evolution on Jupiter. The evolutionary path we undergo during the Earth cycle, by means of which we permeate ourselves with a human ego nature, refining the lower aspects of our being up until now, and in future developing higher aspects, is something that other more advanced beings whom we call angels or angeloi have already previously undergone in former embodiments of our planet, on Moon, Sun, and Saturn. For them, too, there was formerly a kind of fourth aspect or member that they evolved. And then, in the second half of a particular planetary embodiment, they prefigured what would fully unfold in them in the future, on Earth, in the same way that we will prefigure what is to come about on Jupiter. At that time, they did not fully incorporate it into themselves as their possession, but related to it as something which they looked up to. If we look back, firstly, to old moon evolution, we must speak of beings who, just like we human beings, during Earth evolution, should have attained to the seventh aspect of their being. Yet, like us too, not in the sense of making it their full possession, but of looking up to it. When we speak of luciferic beings, we are talking of those who, during old moon evolution, remained at the stage a human being would remain at, who during Earth evolution does not develop his fifth, sixth, or seventh aspects, who refuses to do so, perhaps stopping at the fourth or fifth. These beings did not evolve fully, in other words, and now stand at many diverse stages of development. Thus we can say that human beings passed over from old moon evolution to Earth evolution in such a way that they brought with them a normal path of evolution. Those human beings who concluded their evolution brought a normal evolutionary path with them, their physical, etheric, and astral bodies. And their real task on Earth is to develop the ego. Other beings, higher than man, were meant to develop on old moon what in them corresponds to the human ego. But they would only have been able to develop this moon ego fully by prefiguring all that would have been their fifth, sixth, and seventh aspects, the fifth of which they would need to bring to full completion during Earth evolution. They should have prefigured these aspects as far as the seventh. They did manage just about to evolve the fifth or sixth, did not get stuck at the fourth as such, therefore, but nevertheless were not able fully to develop it, because they failed to prefigure the fifth, sixth, and seventh aspects, remaining stuck instead at the fifth or sixth. So we can distinguish two sorts of such moon beings. Those, firstly, who managed to evolve their fifth aspect, as we humans would if we evolved the spirit self in the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, and then stopped short and failed to develop the sixth and seventh aspects. We can imagine this kind of luciferic beings who evolved their fifth aspect, and then examine the other kind of luciferic moon beings who evolved their sixth aspect, but not their seventh. Both kinds existed at the beginning of Earth evolution, when man was preparing to develop his ego. So, what was the situation for these beings at the beginning of Earth evolution? There were beings present who were hungrily waiting to develop their sixth aspect during Earth evolution. Luciferic beings who had only managed to evolve as far as their fifth aspect on the moon and wished to develop their sixth on Earth. And there were also beings of the second kind present, who had evolved their sixth aspect on the moon and now wished to develop their seventh on Earth. That is what they expected from Earth evolution. And this was when man, with three aspects so far evolved, made the transition to Earth in order to evolve his fourth. So we can distinguish man waiting to evolve his ego, then the luciferic beings waiting to evolve their sixth, and those waiting to evolve their seventh aspects. We will disregard the luciferic beings who wished to develop their fifth aspect, who also existed. This gives us three kinds of microcosmic earth beings. Three kinds of beings who had arrived in the arena of earth evolution. Of these three, only one could attain a physical body on earth. For the conditions earth provides, by means of its whole earthly circumstances, for physically incarnate bodily evolution can only be provided for a fourth human aspect. Only a being that wished to evolve its fourth aspect as ego was able to gain a physical body. The other beings, wishing to develop a sixth and seventh aspect, could not have such a body. For there was no possibility within earth conditions that would have enabled beings entering earth evolution, who were so unsuited to this earth evolution, to acquire a physical body directly. There was no possibility for them to get such a physical body by direct means. So, what must they do? They had to say, quote, "We cannot find direct access to a physical human body consisting of flesh and bones, for such bodies are only available to human beings who wish to develop an ego. Instead, we must resort to a kind of surrogate physical body. We must find human beings who are the most highly evolved, who, let us say, have evolved their fourth aspect. We must crawl into them, and our being must work within them in such a way that it can develop its sixth or seventh aspect." Close quote. This meant that among the ordinary people of ancient times, there were those possessed of higher beings of a luciferic kind, who were naturally more advanced than the human being, since they were trying to evolve their sixth or seventh aspect, while man was still at the stage of evolving his fourth. Such higher luciferic beings, therefore, went about in earthly human bodies. These were the leaders of earthly mankind, for they knew, understood, and were able to do far more than other human beings. We hear tell of these beings in ancient stories and legends, in which they appear as the great founders of cities, great leaders of nations, and so forth. These were not just ordinary human beings, but people possessed of higher beings, of a luciferic kind, possessed in the best sense of the word. We can only rightly understand human earth evolution when we take account of such beings. Particularly the lower beings of this kind continually strive to advance their evolution in one human body after another, since they themselves cannot acquire a body. Luciferic beings have always had a longing to continue their evolution within other human beings by possessing them, and they are still doing this today. Lucifer and his hosts are at work in the human soul. We are the arena of luciferic evolution. Whereas we human beings simply take an earthly physical body to evolve, these luciferic beings take us and evolve within us, and that is our temptation. The fact that luciferic beings are at work within us. In the meantime, though, these luciferic spirits have evolved just as we have. Many a spirit of this kind, who, let us say, was on the verge of developing a sixth aspect at the time man entered the Atlantean period, has now reached the stage, remembering that earth evolution is abnormal for such a spirit, of developing a seventh aspect. He achieves this by taking possession of a human being once more, perhaps spending a number of years using all that this human being can experience as he furthers his own development. This does not do injury to human nature, for the fact that we can bring the consciousness soul to expression at this time means that a luciferic spirit who is in the process of evolving his seventh aspect can possess us. What happens when a high luciferic spirit possesses someone? The person becomes a genius. But one who, because he is a human being possessed and overshadowed by a higher being, is impractical in ordinary daily life. Yet, as a radical, new, and decisive influence in some field or other. One really ought not to speak about such a luciferic spirit as though he were something hateful. He develops like a parasite within the human being, but in such a way that the person possessed and subject to his influence manifests genius, inspiration. Thus the luciferic spirits are absolutely necessary. And people of genius in the world are those in whom, at least for a few years, a luciferic being is hard at work. If that were not the case, then Edward Charest would not have been able to portray Lucifer as a sympathetic being. Lucifer is closely connected with the world's great cultural advances, and it is narrow-minded of traditional Christianity to see in this being nothing more than a wicked devil. This is gross Philistinism. In Faust we read, quote, "Nature is sin, spirit the devil. Between them they nurtured doubt, their malformed child." Close quote. Certainly, it suits the limited horizons of traditional Christianity to regard Lucifer as the devil and to hate him. But a knowledge of human evolution tells us that the luciferic principle is at work in geniuses. The science of the spirit needs to look these things in the face and recognize that we would have no impetus in progressing to our fifth and sixth aspects if these spirits did not move us forward. We do indeed owe this forward propulsion to the luciferic spirits, through the fact that they are striving for their own evolution, and this means we can grow beyond our own limited ego, as is somewhat flippantly said of poets, geniuses, and artists. Thus we look up to the luciferic spirits as leaders of mankind in a certain sense. We must free ourselves from the narrow, orthodox Christian conception that Lucifer is merely a devil to be hated. We must recognize the liberating influence of the luciferic principle that has also been ordained by benevolent gods. For this is what lifts us beyond ourselves in the course of earthly evolution, so that we can prophetically anticipate something that we will not truly own until the time of Jupiter, and so forth. During earth evolution, therefore, reciprocal influence is exerted upon one another by microcosmic beings who were present at the beginning of this evolution. Thus we can say that in developing our own ego, we are led further by beings higher than man, who have already evolved their fifth aspect, and are now developing their sixth or even their seventh aspect, while we are still at work on our fourth. These luciferic beings are thus microcosmic beings higher than man. And now, let us turn aside from these spirit beings, whom we regard as luciferic, and come to examine the nature of Christ. The Christ is radically different from other beings who participate in earthly evolution. He is a being of a quite different order. He is not a being who, like the luciferic spirits, remained behind during moon evolution, but one who, prefiguring moon evolution, remained behind at a still earlier stage, during old sun evolution already, and remained behind through a certain assured wisdom far exceeding that of human beings. We cannot view this being in the same way as the other beings we have referred to as microcosmic ones. Such microcosmic beings are those who have been connected with earth evolution from its beginnings. The Christ was not directly connected with earth evolution, but with sun evolution. He was a macrocosmic being from the beginning of earth evolution onward. In other words, one who is involved in quite different evolutionary conditions from those to which microcosmic beings are exposed. And his evolutionary conditions were specific to him. They were such that this macrocosmic Christ being had evolved the macrocosmic fourth principle outside earthly conditions the macrocosmic ego. For his evolution, for Christ's evolution, it was normal to bring to perfection a macrocosmic ego outside of earthly conditions, and then to descend to earth. Thus, for the evolution of the Christ being, it was normal, as he descended from the macrocosm down to our earth, to bring with him the great impulse of the macrocosmic ego, so that the microcosmic ego, the human ego, could take up this impulse and evolve further. For Christ it was normal to have developed the macrocosmic ego impulse, not the microcosmic ego, as far as human beings had developed the microcosmic ego on earth. Thus the Christ being is a being similar in a certain sense to man, except that man is microcosmic and has brought his four principles to microcosmic expression, his ego also as microcosmic earth ego, while the Christ manifests a cosmic ego. But his evolution had progressed in a way that meant he had grown very great and significant through the full development of this ego that he brought down to earth. And he did not yet have the fifth and sixth macrocosmic principles, for he will develop these so that he can give them to man on Jupiter and Venus. The Christ is therefore a being of fourfold nature, up to and including his macrocosmic ego, as man is at the microcosmic level. And just as man has the mission to evolve his ego during earth in order to receive, so did the Christ have the mission of evolving his ego in order to give. When he descended to earth, everything in his being was directed at bringing his fourth principle to expression in as perfect a form as possible. Now every microcosmic principle has an inner relationship with the corresponding macrocosmic one. The fourth macrocosmic principle in Christ corresponds to the fourth microcosmic principle in man, and the fifth in Christ will correspond to man's spirit self. Thus Christ began his earthly course by bringing down to man from the macrocosm what he needed to develop in the microcosm, but he brought it as macrocosmic principle. He entered into earthly evolution in such a way that he did not possess a fifth, sixth, and seventh principle, just as man did not. The Christ is a being who has evolved macrocosmically as far as the fourth principle, and who, during the course of earth, undertakes the evolution of his fourth principle through bestowing everything that man needs to develop his ego. A complete overview, therefore, shows us that there were three types of being at the beginning of earth evolution. Human beings who were to receive their fully developed fourth principle on earth, a class of luciferic beings who were to evolve their sixth principle, and another class who were to evolve their seventh. The fact that these latter beings were to develop their sixth and seventh principles means that in this respect they stand higher than man. But they also stand higher than Christ in this respect, for Christ is at the stage of bringing his fourth principle to expression on the earth in devotion to mankind. The Christ will not be the one who, let us say, stimulates human beings to bring something to expression other than the actual ego, the inmost being of man, to reach higher and higher levels. It is the luciferic spirits who will do this, who will in a certain sense lead human beings beyond themselves. An external view of things could therefore lead one to say, quote, in that case the Christ is actually lower than luciferic spirits, for he comes to earth with something that is closely related to man's fourth principle. Close quote. It is true that he does not try to lead man beyond himself, but only deeper into his own soul nature. He strives to bring man's individual being of soul increasingly into itself, into its own. The Luciferic beings have developed the fourth, fifth, sixth principle, and therefore are, in a certain sense, higher than Christ. In practical terms, this will in future come to expression in the fact that by taking up the Christ principle into human nature, this nature will grow more and more profound, will take up more and more light and love within itself, so that human nature will necessarily experience light and love as its deepest, ultimate possession. The gift of the continual, ever-ongoing Christ impulse will be the endlessly deepening inwardness of the human soul. And when Christ comes, as has been described in various lectures, his only effect will be in deepening human souls. The other spirits, who have higher principles than the Christ, although only of microcosmic nature, will in a certain sense lead man beyond himself. Christ, on the other hand, will make people more inward, but also more humble. The Luciferic spirits will lead man beyond himself and make him clever, bright, a genius, but also give him a certain haughtiness, will teach him that he can become superhuman already during Earth evolution. Therefore, everything that will, in future, lead man to something, as it were, beyond himself, that will make him proud of his own human nature, here on Earth already, will be a Luciferic influence. From Christ will come, in contrast, all that deepens us, that, in relation to our inner life, will deepen us in a way which is only possible through the full development of the fourth principle. People who take an external view of things will say, Christ is really lower than Luciferic beings, for he only develops the fourth principle, while they develop higher ones. Yet there is a difference. These other beings develop the higher principles as though parasitically grafted onto human nature, while the Christ develops the fourth principle by fully empowering, permeating, and penetrating human nature with it. Just as the flesh and blood of Jesus of Nazareth was once empowered, permeated, and penetrated by the fourth macrocosmic principle, so will the bodies of those be permeated with the fourth macrocosmic principle who take Christ up into themselves. And in the same way that the fourth macrocosmic principle is the gift of Christ, the sixth and seventh principles will be the gift of Luciferic spirits. In future, a time will come, which is already beginning to dawn, when people lacking in wisdom will say, quote, yes, when we read the Gospels or let work upon us what Christ gave humanity, we see that his teaching does not in the least attain to that height at which other spiritual beings stand who are connected with man. Close quote. It is true that such beings are in a certain sense higher than man, but they cannot permeate the whole human being, only his reason, his intellectual genius. A time will come when people elevate the most powerful and important of these Luciferic spirits, who will try to lead man beyond himself, to a position of great honor and distinction, regarding him as a great leader of mankind. They will state, quote, of course, what Christ was able to give was really only a transitionary stage. Close quote. There are already people who say, quote, who needs the teachings of the Gospels? We've already moved beyond them. Close quote. As I have said, people will look to a spirit of outstanding brilliance, who will take possession of the flesh and blood of a human being and permeate it with his genius. And they will say, quote, he is greater than Christ, for Christ was in reality nothing more than the one who enabled us to develop the fourth principle, while this spirit enables us to get as far as the seventh principle during Earth evolution. Close quote. Thus the Christ spirit and the spirit of this other being will confront one another. The Christ spirit from whom people will be able to hope to receive the mighty macrocosmic impulse of their fourth principle. And the Luciferic spirit who will in a certain sense try to lead them beyond it. People would do well to stand firm and tell themselves that all they should take from Luciferic spirits is what they can look up to in the same way they look down on their lower nature. But inasmuch as people come to think that Christ can only offer the fourth principle, while other spirits provide the sixth and seventh, they will come to worship and elevate the Antichrist. Thus will the Antichrist gain ascendancy over Christ in the future. And we will be able to make no objection to this with our outward reason and insight. For it will be possible to point to many things in which the Antichrist demonstrates greater intellect and genius than the deepest human Christ principle increasingly flowing into the soul. Christ brings us the fourth macrocosmic principle, which, because it is macrocosmic, is infinitely more important than all microcosmic principles. It is stronger than them, although it is related to the human ego, stronger than everything else that can be attained in the course of Earth evolution. But because it is merely the fourth principle, people will say that what Christ brings is lower than the fifth, sixth, seventh principles that come from Luciferic spirits, and in particular, is lower than what comes from the Antichrist. It is important that people pursuing the science of the Spirit gain insight into this, already in respect of the teachings of Copernicus, which, as it were, showed us the earth in movement, tore it away from the fixity in which it had formerly been placed, and set it orbiting the sun, showing how the earth is a speck of dust in the cosmos. People say, quote, "How can the Christian idea survive in the face of that?" Close quote. People engineer a contradiction between the Christian idea and this science by saying that in former times one could look up to the cross of Golgotha and to Christ, for then it seemed the earth was a chosen place in the cosmos, and the other planets looked small and as though there for earth's purposes. At that time, one can say, man regarded the earth as worthy of bearing the cross of Golgotha. But when Copernican teachings took off, people started saying rather sarcastically that since the other planetary bodies are at least of equal significance with the earth, Christ must have wandered from one to the other. Since the other planets are mostly much larger than the earth, it is, they said, rather strange that this God-man completed his work of redemption on our little world. A Nordic scholar actually said this. He said that the Christ drama appeared to him like performing a large-scale, star-studded production in a village hall instead of a grand theater. He thought it was ridiculous not to have the greatest drama of the world performed on a large planet. An odd way of thinking indeed. And one can reply that the Christ legend itself has made it clear that one ought not to say such idiotic things, for it starts in a poor barn rather than some noble, wealthy place. This is as much as to say that one should not make the kind of objection that the Nordic scholar came out with. What people often do not consider is how inconsistent they are with their very clever ideas. This idea simply does not hold up in the face of the great simple truth that is already contained in Christian legend. And if this Christian legend places the birth of Jesus in a poor barn rather than a palace, it seems natural that the earth, rather than the largest planets, should be chosen as the place to bear the cross. The whole way, in fact, in which Christian teachings describe what Christ had to bring mankind anticipates those great teachings which the science of the Spirit should nowadays give us once more. When we let the Gospels work upon us, we can find there the deepest spiritual scientific truths, as we have often seen. But how is this great wisdom contained in the Gospels? It strikes me that if those people who do not have a single spark of the Christ impulse in them are to elevate themselves to an understanding of what is written in the Gospels, they must more or less turn their brains upside down, even develop a certain quality of genius. That normal consciousness does not suffice is clear from the fact that so few people have any understanding at all for a spiritual, scientific interpretation of the Gospels. Through luciferic powers, by developing genius, one can only gain a purely external understanding of the Gospels. But how do their truths appear to us in the actual form they are given? We encounter them as if they pour forth unstinted, like ripest goodness, from what we call the being of Christ, without effort, without any strain, and speak directly to hearts that allow themselves to be imbued with the Christ impulse, illuminating and warming the soul through and through. The manner in which these greatest gifts of wisdom come to man is the opposite of the manner in which intellectual cleverness works. These truths pour forth fully formed from the fourth macrocosmic principle in Christ Jesus, in a direct, elemental, original way, so that they can pass directly to human beings. Yes, pains have been taken to ensure that human cleverness, all luciferic sharp-wittedness in human evolution, will expend much effort in trying to interpret these words of Christ, and only very gradually work through to their simplicity and grandeur, to their fundamental nature. And as with Christ's words, so also with his deeds. If we describe a fact such as the resurrection with the means that spiritual science provides, what strange fact do we encounter? A very important German theosophist, Troxler, stated in the 1820s already that one could see how human reason was increasingly imbued with a luciferic principle. He said that human reason was wholly luciferic in all its efforts to grasp things. In general, it is hard to explain deeper theosophical wisdom. Those of you who were at my lecture cycle in Prague will remember that I referred to Troxler at the time in order to show that he already knew something which can now be taught about the human etheric, or life body. He stated, as I said, that human intellect is imbued with luciferic forces. If, without recourse to these luciferic forces, we now try to grasp the resurrection through our good theosophical powers, we have to say that something significant occurred at the Jordan baptism, that the macrocosmic Christ being, who subsequently lived on the earth for 3 years, penetrated the three bodily sheaths of the Saint Luke Jesus. And these then passed through the mystery of Golgotha with the Christ being. Christ Jesus' course of development during these 3 years was naturally different from that of other human beings. How can we use the principles of spiritual science to grasp the essence of the resurrection? What actually occurred? Jesus of Nazareth stood by the River Jordan. His ego, separated from the physical, etheric, and astral bodies, and the macrocosmic Christ being descended, took possession of these three bodies, and then lived until 3 April of the year 33, as we can discover. But this was life of a different kind. For beginning already before the baptism, this life of Christ in the body of Jesus of Nazareth was a slow dying process. With every advancing stage during these 3 years, one can say that something of the bodily sheaths of Jesus of Nazareth died. Gradually these sheaths died away, so that after 3 years the whole body of Jesus of Nazareth was close to being a corpse, and was only held together by the power of the macrocosmic Christ being. You should not imagine that this body in which Christ lived was, say, a year and a half after the Jordan baptism, the same as any other body. An ordinary human soul would have immediately felt this body falling away from it, for it could only be held together by the mighty macrocosmic Christ being. This was a continual slow death over 3 years. And this body had reached the verge of dissolution when the mystery of Golgotha occurred. And then all that was necessary was for those men, as it is related, to come to treat the body with their strange spices, creating a chemical union between these particular special substances and the body of Jesus of Nazareth, in whom the macrocosmic Christ being had lived for 3 years, and then lower it into the grave. Very little was needed for this body to fall to dust in the grave, and for the Christ spirit to clothe itself, one can say, in an etheric body, condensing into visibility. Thus the risen Christ was wrapped in an etheric body condensed into visibility. He went about in this way, and appeared to those to whom he was able to appear. He was not visible to all, since it was really only a condensed etheric body that he bore after resurrection. What had been placed in the grave crumbled into dust, and the most recent occult researches confirm that an earthquake did indeed occur. It was striking for me to find a suggestion in the Gospel of St. Matthew that an earthquake had occurred, after discovering this fact through occult research. The earth opened, the dust of the corpse fell into the chasm, and united with the whole substance of the earth. The violent trembling caused by the earthquake shook and scattered the cloths, as described in the St. John's Gospel. It is wonderfully described in the St. John Gospel. This is the occult way of grasping the resurrection, which does not need to conflict with what the Gospels say. I have often pointed out that Mary Magdalene did not recognize the Christ when he met her. How could she not recognize someone whom she had seen only a few days before, especially when this was such an important individuality as Christ Jesus? When it is related that Mary Magdalene did not recognize him, it must be because she encountered him in a different form. She only recognizes him when she hears him speak, as it were. Then she becomes aware of him. And all details in the Gospels become comprehensible to us from an occult perspective. Yet someone might object that the risen one, when he appeared to the disciples, urged Thomas to touch his wounds. One might therefore think that these wounds were still there, and that Christ had come to the disciples in the same body that had crumbled into dust. No. Just imagine that someone has a wound. The etheric body contracts more tightly at this point, forms a kind of scar. And in this particularly contracted etheric body, from which the constituents of the new etheric body were drawn, with which the Christ being clothed himself, were especially dense places, so that Thomas too could sense that this was a reality. This gospel passage is particularly wonderful from an occult perspective. It in no way contradicts the fact that we have here an etheric body condensed to visibility through the power of Christ, paving the way for the Emmaus scene. This is described in the gospel not as an ordinary intake of nourishment, but as a dissolution of food directly through the etheric body, through Christ's power, without involvement of the physical body. All these things can nowadays be understood by following the esoteric principles of spiritual science. The Gospels can, in a certain sense, be taken literally, apart from passages that have been badly translated. It is wonderful how every small detail comes into focus and can be understood. And those who see this can, on noticing some contradiction, say to themselves, quote, "I am still not clever enough to understand this," close quote. They feel less clever, in quotes, than modern theologians who say they cannot understand the resurrection as described in the Gospels. But by grasping the fundamental aspect of things, we can indeed understand it. What impression does all this make on human intellect and reason? Well, it has the effect that people say, quote, "If I am to believe in the resurrection, then I must erase all that I have so far attained through logic and reason. I cannot do that. So the resurrection must be demolished instead." Close quote. The reason that speaks like this is imbued with Luciferic character, which cannot grasp these things. It will increasingly come to reject the great fundamental words and facts of former times, and those surrounding the mystery of Golgotha. But the science of the Spirit will be called upon to grasp these things right down to their smallest details. It will not reject what can extend beyond the fourth macrocosmic principle as fifth, sixth, and seventh principles. But nevertheless, it will see in the former the greatest impulse that has been given to Earth evolution. But from this you can see that understanding the Christ aspect of Earth evolution is not completely straightforward, since the objection is, in a certain sense, justified that particular spirits, Luciferic spirits, lead us onward toward other, but only microcosmic, principles. I have previously expressed this by saying that Christ is a kind of center, a focal point, where being works through deed, through what it is itself. Surrounding Christ, there sit the 12 bodhisattvas of the world, who are illumined by what radiates from Christ, and who elevate it, through working upon it with their wisdom firstly, to higher principles. But from the fourth principle there also radiates everything that illumines these higher principles, inasmuch as these evolve during earth. A great deal of error in regard to the uniqueness of Christ is caused by the fact that people are unclear that Christ represents not just the fourth principle, but the fourth macrocosmic principle, and that though higher principles can be developed, these are only microcosmic principles, developed by beings who did not complete their evolution on Old Moon. Nevertheless, in their own way, they stand higher than man, for they evolved during Moon evolution what people on Earth still need to evolve. If we wish to understand the true place of the Christ principle within Earth evolution, and be clear why in future the Antichrist will, in many respects, be set higher than Christ himself, we need to elevate ourselves to an understanding of such things as have here been described. The Antichrist may appear cleverer, perhaps, may seem to possess greater intellectual brilliance than Christ, and will gain a powerful following. But the science of the Spirit should prepare itself to withstand the deception that has been characterized here. Above all, a sure anchorage in good spiritual scientific principles will be needed to avoid being deceived in this realm. The task and mission of the esotericism that has developed in the West since the 13th century, and which we have often referred to, was above all to elaborate and clearly reveal what can be said in this respect about Christ. Those who stand firm on the solid ground of this esotericism will recognize more and more clearly the central place of Christ for Earth evolution. And increasingly, people will come, in contrast to all the supposed reincarnations of Christ on Earth, to recognize this simple fact. Just as a pair of scales can only be supported by one focal point, not two or more, so must Earth evolution have a central fundamental impulse. Those who assume that Christ incarnates several times make the same mistake as someone who thinks that scales must be supported at two points in order to function properly. It doesn't work. And a being that walked the earth in several incarnations would not be Christ. This is what every trained occultist will come to see in relation to the nature of Christ. A simple comparison can always illumine the uniqueness of the nature of Christ. And in that sense, too, the Gospels and the science of the Spirit are in complete harmony. The end of Lecture 13.